Welcome to another episode of Fratello on Air. I'm Balazs Renzi, coming to you from Karlsruhe, Germany, without Mike in London, or from London this time. Instead, I'm joined by a true, 21st century Renaissance man. He's a New York Times bestselling author of books such as Absurdistan, Little Failure, or Super Sad True Love Story, if I'm correct, an unintentional food and drink influencer, Canadian tuxedo marvel, watch fanatic, and all-around nice guy, my friend Gary Steingart. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. So
stop it.
Yeah. You're not.
Yes, you are. Awesome. We wanted to do this last week, and sadly we had to reschedule, but I'm very happy that a few weeks before Christmas, we managed to do this because you were busy. First we talked about this, I think, in November, and you said, "Could we do December?" Because you were busy. Can you tell us about that, or shall we just?
No, I can tell you. I was finishing up a draft of the novel I've been working on, and I finished it up. I even managed to squeeze out a second draft. So now there's some more edits, and hopefully the third draft will be the last one. A book I've been writing for a while. Actually, a book. I keep doing this with my books. I write something, then I hate it, and I throw the whole thing out, and then I just start over again, and then I usually, knock on wood, get it right. So, I was busy editing a book, which should come out, I'm guessing, in 25, because in 24, when we have a really serious election year in America, nobody has the capacity to even register fiction. Everyone's just worried about what's going to happen next. So 25, hopefully.
So how's the, you write the draft, and then once it's done, then you start working on the story, and then you basically fill up the pages?
Yeah. I mean, I have an idea, and then I fill up the pages. Then I send it to my editor, who's excellent, and the editor will, he's also very honest. So there's been times where he's like, "Gary, this voice is just terrible." Because getting fiction right is all about getting the voice of your characters right. And that's when you nail that, everything just flows right out. And if you don't, then you got to really start all over again. So that's been happening to me quite a bit. But this time I wrote the main draft in 51 days after writing a draft I threw out for a year. So just goes to show how you can labor on something for a very long time and produce nothing good, or you can go into a kind of almost insane fugue state where you're just chained to your laptop and you pump out an entire novel in less than 2 months. So that's what I was doing. And now it's really great to surface again. I can, go out, have a couple of drinks, or more than a couple of drinks, and
we get to that in a minute.
Yeah, and I've been even stopping by the watch shops when I'm in New York. I split half my time between New York and the upstate, sort of the countryside north of New York. So I've been going between those two places, and I feel like I'm rejoining society and civilization again.
And that's the perfect time to rejoin civilization, just a few weeks before Christmas, right?
That's right.
Most wonderful time of the year, as they say. Is it going to be any watch content in the new book or the new story? No.
It's so funny you ask, because that's the question. So watch nerds often ask me when they see me on the streets, like, this new book, is it going to have watches? No, in fact, it is set from the point of view of a young child, a 10-year-old kid. So obviously she doesn't have a watch collection.
But she could have a flick-flack.
She could have a flick-flack, but I decided that my kid has two flick-flacks, but I decided not to burden her with this addiction. But her father collects engraved fountain pens, which is not a hobby of mine. But I wanted him to have some kind of hobby and to be a quote-unquote manfluencer on IG. So
That's pretty cool. Yeah. I mean, I think pens and watches, they often go hand in hand.
They do.
They're small objects. They're quite expensive. They're nicely done. They're beautiful. They're like some of them even probably more expensive than some watches. So it's a cool thing.
Yeah, it's a cool thing, and also pointless, like a watch, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Twenty-first century, it's absolutely needless to have a pen.
Needless.
I have a pen. I have a couple. Of course, I have a couple of pens. I have a beautiful Mont Blanc and stuff, and it's here on the table, and I'd use it because it's there and because I have it. But if I didn't, I would just use one of these Sharpies and
I agree completely. Well, I've never had this hobby, but I'm going to try to, as I try to push this last version, this last edit out, I want to meet up with Jack Forrester, who in the city doesn't live that far from me. And I want to hijack him for a dinner or something where he can, because I think he has a couple of really amazing pens. So I want to, you know, make sure that anything I've written passes, you know, his high standards, but also to sneak a peek at somebody who really does have wonderful pens.
Yeah, it's funny once you dip your beak in the watch world, when you, obviously in your book everybody will ask you the same question, right? What's the next book about? What's the watch in the main character is going to wear? That's just how it is. Well, listen, usually we have a wrist check or a Handgelenkskontrolle.
Handgelenkskontrolle,
Mike and I will call it. For a while we used to have a different name, but people miss the Handgelenkskontrolle.
I love Handgelenkskontrolle. It's just so much fun to say that. Maybe the only two words of German that I know, you know, so.
Well, if you speak a bit of Yiddish, then I'm sure there's a few more.
But
Handgelenkskontrolle is what it is. And also, the last time I did, it was a collector's talk, obviously, with Boschko a few weeks ago. We did a pour check, which is from the Spirit of Time podcast. Those guys started it, Matt and Greg. And I was drinking something and Boschko saw it. And then I asked you before we started recording if you have a drink with you, and you do.
I do.
So what if we do a pour check? And then we do a Handgelenkskontrolle.
I love it. Let's do it.
What are you drinking?
Okay, I'll start. So I have an Amaro. I love Amaro. I love digestifs. I just had a very spicy lunch of some kind of garlic boquerones. So I'm having a digestif, an Amaro that is made by somebody I befriended recently. He runs a company called Fort Have Spirits. I don't know if I'm pronouncing correctly. Forthave. And this is the Marseille Amaro. A beautiful bottle.
What's the logo?
The logo is the...
Is the mask?
When I first, well, it's the mask that doctors used to wear in like...
The plague.
The plague, exactly. Yeah. But when I first saw that, I was like, oh, it's a bird. So cool. You know?
No, it's not.
He explained the rather... macabre reason for the logo, but at first I thought it was like a cool little bird. He lives up here, and Fort Have is based in Brooklyn. So, like me, he splits his time between what I think of as paradise up here and the hustle and bustle of the city. And he has all this booze, so I was very happy to be friends. I actually spent Thanksgiving at his house, and that was very charming.
Awesome. Well, I'm having pretty standard Negroni.
Nothing fancy.
The thing is, I was actually I was training some sports, and I just got home like 10 minutes ago, so I just quickly made a drink, and I thought, well, I have to have that. So not really the best thing to have after an hour of training, but hey.
Did we have a Negroni when we first met?
I have no idea what we had. That's exactly what I wanted to first talk about. But let's do the Handgelenkskontrolle. And I have to admit something, man. I was so in a rush that I don't have a watch on me.
Oh my God.
But I was wearing my 1675. And it's somewhere in my bag. And the reason I was wearing the watch is because you have one. We're basically skipping a bit ahead. But I have a 1675 GMT Master from 1967.
Oh, and, beautiful.
And you have one. Yeah. What's yours? Which year is yours?
I think it could be 67 was still tritium, right?
Yeah.
Well, not tritium. I'm sorry. 67 was still gilt.
No, it's not. It's not.
It's not. Okay. Then mine is whatever year it was before they switched to, that could have been 66, I think.
65, 66, yeah.
65, 66, possibly. Yeah, that sounds about right. No, it was right before the Switch. And it was a very interesting watch. It still is an interesting watch that belonged to this guy who was a colonel in the Air Force. And he was basically the PR guy for NASA for a long time.
Awesome.
And then when he bought this watch in around Cape Canaveral, he was sort of the liaison to Nixon's White House. No, this was before. After he bought the watch, right, because Nixon wasn't in the presidency.
So
the liaison to Nixon's White House.
So the Gilt was in production from 59 to 64. Oh. And from 65 to 80, it was Matt Dial. So mine is 67. So yours must have been 1964 or before. But
very interesting.
But maybe he bought it like an old stock.
Maybe he bought it later because it was such a full set. This guy, like any soldier or Air Force guy, he had everything was in complete. The kit was so complete. He actually collected more than one bracelet. So there was a Jubilee and an Oyster bracelet. He had several bezels.
Cool.
He had Coke and Pepsi and root beer. I mean, it's like. And obviously all the paperwork. So I think that maybe that's why I'm thinking of later, because I think the paperwork from Cape Canaveral or thereabouts was a later date. But I have never seen any set like this. It's completely bananas. I read some of the stuff he'd written. So he was assigned to Nixon's White House to try to, I guess, make a plug for NASA. But the guy that he had to deal with was this very corrupt VP. What's his name? Spiro Agnew. Who I don't think going to the moon was like very big on Spiro's, bingo card. I think he wanted to steal things on Earth. I was reading some stuff of his, and it's what a fascinating life this guy led. And I really enjoyed, I enjoyed just this history of having it certainly be at the vice president's house where Spiro was, but possibly in the White House, I'm sure at some point too, given that.
Awesome.
And not just any White House, but Nixon's White House, that entails all the good stuff.
Crazy. But the funny thing is you said you have both bracelets, yet I see you wearing it mostly on a leather strap.
Well, I have a tiny wrist, a really tiny wrist, like just over 6 inches, right? So when it comes to, I'm not even going to try a maxi dial professional sports Rolex, but when I wear 1675, something vintage from that era, I'm always going to put it on a beautiful leather strap. I think it actually looks better, frankly. And I love wearing watches that I can swim with, but since I'm not going to swim with the 1675, I might as well put it on something that I think is very beautiful.
Not too long ago, I was traveling with mine and I was seeing a friend who's got a watch shop. And I said, I have the 1675 on the wrist. Why don't you put it in the pressure test and see if it's water resistant? I've never had it serviced. Yeah. I bought it serviced many years ago, 7 years ago. So I guess it should be serviced now. But he put it in the pressure tester and it's water resistant to 50 meters. He said he didn't want to put more on it because it might crack the crystal. But it's amazing late 60s.
Yeah. Yeah,
I could swim with it technically.
You could swim with it technically, and I had my 1675 from, as we've now established, possibly 64, and I also have a 1016, which definitely is, I want to say 63 because it's the exclamation dial. I think it's around that point, so or 62. I always get
it's like, Explorer One for those of you listeners who don't know what the 1016 is. Yeah,
yeah, and he pressure tested both of them, and these are 40. Again, math is not my thing, but
it's more 50, 60, 55, 67. Yeah, 60 years.
60 years. 60-year-old Rolexes. And like yours, they were fine at 50 ATMs. So it's amazing. It really is amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, so that was on my wrist, but what's on your wrist?
So on my wrist is one of my favorite watches, and it is the Alange und Sonne. I guess I speak a little more German than just Handgelenkskontrolle because Sonne, I guess, is and Sons. And it is the Saxonia Thin.
Beautiful.
In white gold.
Beautiful.
White gold. One of my favorite all-time watches. One of the reasons I think I'm like everyone else, I'm always tempted by the new independent watches that constantly try to assault my pocketbook. But I think what I really love in dress watches such as this is having a thin dress watch, as they were once meant to be. Think about, I think your colleague has the Patek 570. That's a watch that's always intrigued me because of its sort of sculpturally beautiful thinness.
Yeah.
And a lot of the independents, and I know they are doing it in part because they want to create a very three-dimensional effect with the very complicated movements they're making, and also, you know, interior angles, all that stuff requires more room to maneuver. But for me, nothing. I'm tempted, but then I never quite pull the trigger because this watch and I think I've said this before, it's like having a pocket watch on your wrist in the smallest, thinnest format imaginable. The movement is exceptional, of course, but also until you take it off and look at the back of it, it just feels like one of those Piaget Altoplanos or whatever they're called.
Right.
So yeah. Beautiful watch.
No, it is, absolutely. And we'll get to your collection because I really want to talk. I think there's quite a few themes going on, but mm-hmm. before we jump into that, we wanted to mention, you mentioned the drinks and that special evening. And this is my favorite story of the years. I'm telling you. How can my colleague, he every time, you know, this event comes up, he always tells me, like, tell the story about Gary, because it's so funny. And the story goes that we had an event in New York. I think I've talked about this one of the previous podcasts. We had an event, and you and I, we've never met, right?
Yeah.
Before, you followed me on Instagram, and I followed you, and I sent you a message, and I said, "Hey, we're in New York. You know, we both love watches and whatever. Why don't you come to the event?" Yeah. And in true, you know, New Yorker fashion, you said, "I'll try to make it," which is like, yeah. Maybe, maybe not. It's a big city. It offers, you know, a lot of entertainment.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
So I was like, okay, whatevs. You know, he will come or not. Mm-hmm. And then I was at the event and I was talking to someone. And as I see at the corner of my eye, I see a bit of a commotion. So at the end of the bar, there's like, I guess watch fans are happy to see you, or maybe friends of yours, maybe not. But there was like a few people kind of swarming around you and talking to you. And I said, wow, Gary came. I have to say hello to him. Ooh. Obviously, I invited him to the party. So I came over to you and I tapped you on the shoulder, and you turned around and you said, "Hey, Balázs, I was listening to your podcast this morning." Mm-hmm. And you caught me off guard with that, because it's a nice thing to say, but it's like, whatever. But you actually did, because you quoted from the podcast that I recorded a few days ago.
No, that was such a I haven't been that drunk in a long time, I have to say. I can drink fairly prodigiously, but it was at one of my favorite places in New York, the Campbell Apartments, which is sort of right above Grand Central. It's definitely my favorite place in Midtown, which is not a neighborhood I find myself in often. I was having a really great time. I actually had met all these people that I either didn't know at all, or they followed me on Instagram. Maybe I followed them, I showed up, but whenever I hear like free drinks in a bar I really like, that gets me so excited and I will, you know, push around my schedule and definitely come to those. But the evening was very lubricated for me, because first there were the very intense free drinks that were given out, yes, very good ones too. I think one of them was a Negroni, but there were also the penicillin, I think, was floating around.
Yeah, that's some whiskey sours and things like
sours.
That.
Whiskey sours. You know, and actually, as somebody born in the Soviet Union, like, vodka I can handle for like 20 drinks, no problem. But I think it's these whiskey-based and all these other things that really mess me up. But so, you know, that, and after a while, the free part ended. But there were all these really nice people whom I kind of detest now, because they, you know, they were just like, "Gary, let me get you." Everyone was sort of lining up to get me a drink. And by the end of the evening, it's hard to say, no, I thank you. You know,
people
are so sweet. So I just kept drinking and drinking. And my buddy Henry Flores, who you've probably met, right?
Shout out to Henry.
Sweet guy.
Sweetest
who runs the Classic Watch Club, which is my get together in New York. And he tells me the story. He's like, by the end of it, the bartender was like, "I'm not giving him any more drinks." And I haven't had that happen to me since my 20s. So I was pretty excited.
It was great. I was talking to you, and then I let you, you know, after like 5 minutes, I said, okay, I let him, you know, mingle. And I saw you leaving, and I had some other people to talk to. And I saw you leaving a few times. I said, okay, now he's gone. And I would always see you coming back. back, or I'm like, I talked to three people, and then here he's there again. He's at the bar, he's at the entrance. And then at the end of the show, at the end of the night, as you said, we had to go out, right, to this other bar, and you're still there with Henry. So I'm like, okay, well, apparently you really enjoyed the evening.
No, it's also that people would sort of push me back in and be like, you know, you got to come back in, or and I tried to leave once, and then there was another bar outside, and they kind of stopped me and said, no, you can't just leave yet. There was actually, I can't remember her name, but there was a watch journalist I've always followed, but now I can't remember her name. But anyway, she bought me drinks, and I was like, all right, you know, and then I was herded back into the Campbell apartment. It was really a night to remember. I felt like I was very very young again.
It was a great night. It was really a great night. And we have a beautiful picture, the two of us. Print it and frame it and put it on the wall. it was a great night, and we had a good fun. And that's when we first met, and since then we've been talking on and off. And as I said, you were gracious enough to do this with me. But listen, you talked about watches, and I'm sure 1,000 times this question has been asked, but never on Fratello on Air. Where does the love for watches come to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff. And I did a piece for The New Yorker when I first fell in love with watches. This is back in 2016, I want to say.
What's your earliest memory of a watch?
The article mentions one of my earliest memories. And it's not just a memory. It's a very long memory. And it's when I emigrated from Leningrad to the United States, to Queens, New York. I was sent to this religious school that I hated with every inch of my body. And also, I didn't speak English. I was kind of bullied. But I had this watch, and it was the Casio musical alarm watch, which I kind of want to get a version of it. I bought one, but then I gave it away as a gift, and I kind of find a perfect example. It's really cute, and it plays, like, I think 12 melodies or more melodies. Yeah, more than 12, because I don't know. A lot of melodies, including the Russian song Kalinka Malinka, which I grew up listening to. It's a very folksy Russian song. So
I think it was also the song of the Tetris games. Oh, it was. Right?
Okay. There you go. I love this watch, and it was, as I say, very sadly, kind of my only companion for a while, because I didn't speak English, and you know, nobody liked me because I was wearing this giant Russian fur coat and hats, shopka all the time. So it was really miserable. So I loved that watch. Loved it. And I always had a watch. You know, then I guess everyone moved on to Swatches. Then I bought a gold-plated Seiko quartz analog. I took that to college with me. Then for a while, then a girlfriend after college bought me this diesel watch. I guess also quartz, but it had the picture of the world on the dial, and I just thought, "Ooh, this is so cosmopolitan," and, you know. So I always had a watch, and then in 2016, I fell in love with watches and began to really, you know, buy a lot of them.
Yes, you accumulated a beautiful collection.
Thank you. I'm about to post on Instagram the current
SOTC?
30, yes, the SOTC. And I think we're at about 30 watches, which is really time to stop. That's a lot, even for me.
And you had a beautiful Patek on that night. I took the watch. I wanted to try it on. As you said, you have a very small wrist. I have an unfortunately very large wrist, so it was impossible.
I don't know which is worse. Because it's always, I've saved a lot of money because a lot of watches that I like, I just can't wear. So
it's too large. But then the thing is, I really love small watches and I really don't care. So if it's 33 and I like it, I'm going to wear it regardless. Yeah. But you're right. Probably better to. I mean, I don't know if it's better, but I don't mind. But you had the Aquanaut, which is on a bracelet. Which you don't really see it often, right?
Yeah.
You just sit on the rubber strap.
Well, the rubber strap flares out too much again for my wrist. There's a lot of dead space, whereas the bracelet, which I can't say it's the world's prettiest bracelet, but it's not at all. But, you know, the reason I bought it was he was a watch collector who was at that event. I ran into him at another event many years ago, and he was wearing – he also has a tiny wrist, and he was – wearing it on a bracelet, and I tried it on, and we have exactly the same wrist, and I was like, oh, I can do this. And the reason I really love those watches, because one of the sort of sub-themes of my collection are watches that I can swim in. I love swimming, and I love the way watches look underwater, whether it's a pool, an outdoor pool, indoor pool, the ocean, anything. you know, like Balaton, just take me to a body of water, take me to a body of water, and I will enjoy wearing a watch.
And Balaton. And for those of you who don't know, Balaton is the big lake in Hungary. That's pretty much the Hungarian Sea, as they say, because we don't ever see anymore.
I see.
Yeah, it is. Well, funnily enough, for someone who loves watches underwater, you don't really have a lot of divers. And again, I don't want to jump to this topic, but you have like a few Seikos and you have like a Tudor, but you're not diver heavy.
This is the thing. So I approach, and I this may piss some people off, but I'm very much a functionalist, if that's a term for watches. So I love watches that serve the specific needs I have. And knowing the time is a need. Anytime that I don't take out my phone, I feel like I've won over, you know, the digitalization of everything, which is why when executed correctly, I love a good date window, because I actually, as a 51-year-old, I don't know what date it is. You know, I often don't know what month it is. So the more information, I don't know what year it is, the more information you can give me on a dial, I really do appreciate. But it has to be functional. So sure, I swim, but I don't dive. In fact, every time, and I have a Tudor, the Black Bay 58 with the Hodinkee livery, which, you know, because I've written for them and I'm friends with with Ben and a lot of other people. But, you know, every time I wear that, I love the association with them, but I also am like, it just reminds me that I don't dive, and there's this bezel that just reminds me of how inactive I am, you know, whereas a watch that just has 100-meter water resistance reminds me that, hey, I actually exercise by swimming, but not by diving. I'll give you the ultimate example. I love the Patek 3940, which is a super expensive perpetual calendar. And I thought of moving some of my pieces to get that. And I had my buddy Eric Wind. By the way, interesting thing. I think his father is either an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. I can't remember which, but some kind of
Eric
connection. Eric Wind, yeah. Well, but anyway, he sent me these 3940s with all kinds of, you know, because there were many iterations, like I think 4 series plus, you know, different case metals. And I was desperate to be able to read those subdials, but I just can't. You know, somebody made the joke that the perpetual calendar, when you're young, you're too poor to own it, and then you're too old to see it when you can't afford it. So I'm the kind of functionalist that if I can't just look down and see what I'm supposed to see on it, it kind of disturbs me. So maybe that's one reason why I've kept my collection, the 2 watches that to some are quite purist, but I think it's because there's only a few functions that I really love, the date, obviously, or month, and perhaps my favorite is the GMT function because I travel all the time. So that is actually something I find very useful.
So you have a few vintage watches in your collection, and you even have one, the Universal Genève, which is, well, actually it's quite a hot topic these days because of the Breitling acquisition, obviously. Do you change the date? Are you the guys like, you know, in a vintage, there's no quick set, you're changing to the correct date?
Absolutely. I know that once, you know, everything is in rotation in my collection, but I know that once it's time for the tri-compacts to come on, that, you know, I'm going to have to set aside 15 minutes with my toothpick to
put the pusher in.
And also the moon face has to be correct.
Really?
You know, look, if you're going to own this, you might as well enjoy everything that it has to offer, I think.
True.
So I really, God, I love that watch. And one of my books, Lake Success, was sort of centered around that watch. The whole the narrative is about this rich guy who has a huge, much bigger collection than I could ever dream of, but he keeps being drawn to this tri-compacts. And I also own a great UGFS, which is the Ferrovia dello Stato, and the Italian Chuchu. And it has it has the FS logo, which is actually quite cool. And then it also has, which is rare, the name of the actual person to whom it was given, the railroad worker, who's, I think the first name is Paolo, and I can't remember his last name. But that's pretty rare to have both the FS logo and the actual name of the worker. So I love UG so much, I can't even begin to tell you. I'm so glad they're coming back, unless they screw it up.
Well, yeah, it's a 50-50 chance, right? But we've seen, I mean, me being an Angelus fan or collector. Yeah. I mean, well, it is what it is.
They do have Fred Mandelbaum on the case, so that gives me some hope.
Fred's a great guy. Let's hope that they don't screw up. But the other thing, by the way, the other common theme between your collection and my, well, many themes, but other than the GMT, is the Ming. I think that, and I've said this before in the podcast, people that I talk to about Ming, it's either a love it or hate it relationship with Ming.
Yeah. It took me a really long time to build. I mean, I was very curious. I still remember when it came out, the very first, and I can't remember the reference, 1701, something like that,
1709, I think. That's the one that I have, the burgundy. Yeah.
The burgundy. Okay.
The burgundy, yeah.
The very first iteration when it came out, and Jack Forrester had an article in Hodinkee, and it was like, what was it, $900 or something? I can't remember what it was. Something ridiculous. And I was very piqued. My interest was piqued immediately. But I thought, you know, this really isn't the kind of Art Deco styling, this kind of Flash Gordon-y thing was going on. I just, you know, at that point, I wasn't quite ready to commit. But when I saw William Messina, when he did that great collaboration with them that had all these problems attached to it for various reasons.
Yeah, but the alignment of the hands.
The alignment and then something with the way it was allocated. I can't remember. But anyway, it doesn't matter to me because I think they did a really, really great job to working together. And for me, and I have the yellow one, the honey one. I love those honeycomb dials from the, I guess it would be the 50s, right? Rolex. There's a bunch of them. But they all, one of the things I don't buy, because sadly I've had so many of my friends die of cancer, I don't buy radium dials, except that exclamation mark that has a little bit of radium for the 1016. But I've always wanted one of those watches, but because of that reason, I never bought them. And here was something that was very evocative of that. I think Messina talked about how he was influenced by those watches. But I can actually swim in it because I put it on a bracelet, the Ming bracelet, which took forever to be manufactured. It's a joy to swim in. Boy, the light, that dial just soaks up the sunlight. Mm.
Yeah, it's an amazing watch. I actually, when I was in London a few weeks ago, a month ago maybe, Mike gave me because he has a lot of Mings and more than I do, and he gave me one of those water-resistant Ming straps, which are awesome, pretty comfortable.
Yeah, pretty comfortable,
and,
yeah.
And you can swim in that. And what I really love, and I think you don't have it, judging by the picture, he gave me one of those why is it called it? The tuck strap, and you can like tuck the end of the strap under the other. It's a pretty pretty interesting.
That's really cool. You know what I really would love for Ming, which is the same thing I tell every single watch manufacturer that I meet, is I want. He already kind of did this. He had some GMTs, which I really liked.
Yes.
But for me, the GMT, I need a date because when I'm traveling, I really need to know what the date is, you know. And if he could somehow, I know that his designs are so, they're so auteurish, right? He's like David Lynch or some other director that has a very particular kind of style. But for me, again, going back to functionality, I would love to see a Ming with a date and a GMT function or any kind of, it can be collar. I'm fine with collar GMTs. My buddy Jesse Marchant made this watch that I'm crazy about, the Lorca, the Lorca GMT, which I've talked about incessantly, which I just, this summer I went for like a couple of weeks to Asia, just traveling all over the place. And I needed a GMT that I could swim in because I was swimming all the time. It was hot as hell in Asia, and I was wearing the Lorca all the time. It was just a perfect watch. 36 millimeters, yum, yum, yum.
So what was your first serious watch? Is it something you still have it in the collection? Like serious watch?
I've never sold a watch. This is the crazy thing.
Oh, okay.
I've never sold a watch. I don't know why that is. Many of the watches I own, probably a third of them, were gifts from people or companies and stuff. So sometimes now I get paid in watches when I do an event for somebody, which is very cool. I encourage that. But it depends what you mean by serious. So I think the very first mechanical watch I bought was a Jung Hans Max Bill. That I bought for $800, which at the time I thought was like, how does anyone spend $800, you know?
and if you ever come back to Germany, and I hope you will, in Frankfurt, sure. and if you have a day off, I promise you, I'll take you to the Jungkanz factory, because it's like an hour away from here, from where I live.
Okay.
in the Black Forest. And it's a beautiful building.
The terrace kind of building.
The terrace bit, yes. I was there before it became a museum. I was there when it opened. And it's really amazing, and it's not too far from here. Lovely people in Munich.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've never given Frankfurt much thought, but I realized that there's both Jungkanz and I guess Zinn is around there too, right?
So Zinn is in Frankfurt. Jungkanz is in Schramberg. Oh, I see. And you have Hanhart also in the Black Forest.
Oh, okay.
So well, you could do like a trip. No, but let me know, and I'll drive you around.
I always end up landing in Frankfurt before I go to non-Frankfurt like places. But the journey always begins in that gigantic airport.
You could definitely do that. But Jungkanz is close by, and that's a cool. And that's like a very 1930s Bauhaus, clean.
Yeah.
Kind of like the other brand, the German brand.
Nomos.
Yeah, it's the one.
Nomos was the second watch I bought. When I bought the Jungkanz, I didn't even know what a mechanical watch was because I never owned one. When it stopped working, because I guess I didn't move my hand around enough, I was very angry. I was like, what happened to German engineering here? You know, my wife actually called Mr. Jungkanz or something, because she's a lawyer, so she knows how to deal with people. And Mr. Jungkanz was like, just tell him to move his arm or something.
Do this.
So, but I guess, I don't know, because it was under 1,000. I don't know if it was serious to me at the time, but the next watch I bought was the Nomos Minimatique, the Champagner, which I absolutely loved. And I recently did an event for Nomos, the Nomos Forum, which I thought was wonderful. It was, Nomos is so, I just, you know, they're so interesting. They're like, it was me and some kind of a sexologist who taught the, I guess you telling the salespeople how to be sexy. I don't know, something like that. It was almost always, they pull things out of the bag that's like so different from any other watch company. And I just love them for it because it's not going to be the same boring crap, you know, but it was a lot of fun. It was a great, great event. Everybody left very happy. The references they had are always very cool. So, you know, I just love them. I think they still are my favorite, certainly existing brand. Mm. I don't know, everything, they have a sense of humor as in the sexologist and me, as you know, they're just so different, so much more cosmopolitan and sophisticated. And of course, you know, they're based in Glashütte, but they also have the Berlin design department. So
you've been to both places?
I've been to both places several times, actually. And in Berlin, I used to live in Berlin, at the American Academy in Wannsee. Mm-hmm. I was a fellow there, but I got so bored with Wannsee that I rented an apartment. Back then, you could rent an apartment for like €300 in Kreuzberg, which is kind of a hipster.
Which is where their office is, basically.
Which is where their office is, but also where my favorite bar, the Anker Klaus, I believe, which is a bar on a boat.
The anchor of the boat.
So, you know, so I spent a lot of time at that bar. I even know their menu by heart, but you know, I really enjoyed going there, and that's right outside of Nomos headquarters. Yeah. So, I just love them. Great people.
It's a very cool brand. I mean, you go to Glashütte, it's the old train station, I think.
It's the old train station, exactly.
They converted. So basically, when you go to the big meeting room, you can like go out to the platform, technically.
Yes, the big meeting room is overlooks the platform, and that's a really great, the fact that these trains are passing, you know, are passing right by you is just very, very cool. Yeah, I now own 5 Nomoses, which is the most I own of any brand. And I mean, that's like, I don't know, 6 of my collection is Nomos, but I never get tired of changing them up. I actually tan their straps, the straps for the Minimatique. It's this beautiful vegetable-based strap. And I put it out during the summer. I tan it. It comes in a kind of quasi yellow pink color, and I like to make it a more orangey hue and harder. So I tan it outside of my pool upstate, and I let the mist roll in through the valley, and it changes the texture of the strap. So
amazing.
I mean, that's dedication.
Yeah, it is dedication. I was about to say, and it's really cool because you have the Glashütte people and you have, you know, that the platform and everything, but then you go to Berlin, as you said, and it's a completely different world, right? That's what the marketing team is and all that. It's very Berlin, very kind of Bauhaus, but kind of Vitra, kind of Ames, kind of modern and all that stuff. So it's a very cool brand. But listen, it absolutely is. But tell me this: what's the watch? I mean, I only know the collection from last year, right? Because I haven't seen the SOTC, the straight of the collection this year. Mm-hmm. But what's the last one that's leaving your collection? If S hits the fan and everything needs to go, God forbid. What's the one? What's your the most prized possession? It has to be one.
I don't know.
Everybody has one. Gary, come on. Everybody has one. Everybody has one.
I mean, in some ways, because I take the GMT with me to so many places, because I travel so much that a lot of memories have been made with that watch on my wrist. So probably the last 5 or 6, I do a lot of book tours in Europe and Germany, Italy, France, the UK, Ireland, stuff like that. So for me, this GMT, and because of its history, it's so unique because it participated in the guy who owned it truly had a fascinating life. I can't even begin to replicate
because
that
you don't, right?
Because mine's okay, but his was, he was hung, we're talking about Omega, you know, the Speedmaster and going to space. He hung out literally whenever the astronauts would land, he would hang out with Buzz and all those people. Yeah. He'd be on the team that would sort of interview them. And, you know, he was as close to the space program as you can get without being an actual astronaut. So that plus the experiences I've made with this watch make it very hard for me to think of parting it. On the other hand, like, I do love to swim with my watches, and I can't do it with that one. So two contenders would be, the Aquanaut. I think the Aquanaut is great. It's it's a very maligned watch. A lot of people hate it and are like, well, you just wanted the Nautilus. I'm like, no, I actually really like the Aquanaut.
Yeah.
And as a swimmer, I love the way color reflects off of its surface. I also want to throw in two more that I would be hard to part with, which would be the Nomos Hodinkee that came out, I think, a year ago, which was with this blue dial, beautiful. And the date is in the same color as the dial. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I'm also a huge fan of Grand Seiko. And I own the White Birch now. And I just got the...
you got the Schönbund?
The Schönbund, exactly.
The Schönbund, the pink one.
And I love them both. I may love the White Birch a little bit more, but the Schönbund sits better on my wrist because it's a little smaller. But they're both incredible watches, incredible for swimming, obviously, because they're both water resistant. Everything about them just makes me so happy. I would say, you know, and I've said this before, that I think of sort of the new Holy Trinity is Nomos, Grand Seiko, and maybe Tudor.
Interesting. Yeah, I was thinking when you talked about the Nomos and the GMT, do you travel with a lot of watches when you come to wherever?
Never. No? I'm always worried that things will be stolen. And I know, you know, I hate locking things in hotel safes because I always forget the combination and all that. And then, you know, those safes are not entirely impenetrable. People have had stuff stolen from safes. So I rarely do that. I've done it once or twice where I would bring like the GMT to LA and then I would bring a Nomos to swim in because these hotels always have great pools. But that got a little annoying because you'd forget what was where. So no, I only travel with one watch, which usually means either a GMT or a watch that I can swim with. And my buddy's Lorca GMT is one that I love because I can do both with it. And it's not, nobody knows what it is. So nobody's going to steal. I go to a lot of places, a lot of countries where, things aren't as safe as you would hope. Although these days, I think Paris and London are sort of the hotbeds of horological crime. So I don't know, you know.
There you go. I guess you're safer with a GMT in Frankfurt than you are in London, sadly.
Well, or even in maybe Mexico City or somewhere.
Or even in Mexico. Well, there you go. You know, we talk. I'll have a few more questions, but let's go through your collection because, as I said, I have the picture here from last year, and of course you've added some more. But we've talked a bit about The White Birch is a beautiful watch. I'm also a big fan of Grand Seiko, vintage and modern.
Vintage and modern, yeah. I was in Tokyo this summer, and I was hoping to hunt down some excellent vintage stuff, but it was really slim pickings.
I'll tell you some places. I've been there last summer.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe I missed out on it, but the gentleman who runs Hodinkee Japan, Masu, directed me to a couple of places, and I went, and maybe it was actually one of the watches I was looking for. The gentleman said, "Oh, we just sold it," you know. But I ran into like a King Seiko for like $4,000, and the yen is down, so I was expecting great bargains, but I came away with nothing, but I do love vintage
camera shops. If you go back to Tokyo, let me know. I'll send you some, and I even have some contacts there. But yeah, but Grand Seiko is amazing. But then we talked about the Tudor, we talked about the 1016, the Aquanaut. You have a couple of other Rolexes, like
I have one that I absolutely love, which was my favorite modern Rolex by far, and of course Rolex discontinued it because they just couldn't have something so beautiful be in their lineup. It was the Rolex OP39, the white dial, and every time I wear that out and collectors stop me, they're all like, "That's what I want." And I think it like doubled in price or something, even with the current correction. So people really love that watch. And it was really the first modern Rolex where I just thought, despite the maxi case, which is by far not my favorite, and I just said, you know, I really want this watch. And it's so beautiful. That white dial, the way it looks underwater, the way it looks in any light, the way it captures and changes light differently, it's like an endlessly changing palette for a painter. It's just absolutely beautiful. And then I have the 1016, and then I have the cutest watch that I bought for $1,500, my first ever vintage watch, which was a Air King that I bought on a leather strap. They call it the Blue Jean because it's a beautiful blue dial. Beautiful.
But your collection is not too vintage heavy. I mean, you have some amazing pieces, right? You got the 1675, you have the 1016. I mean, that's already, it's like the two watch vintage Rolex collection to a lot of people, right? Vintage Explorer, vintage GMT. We talked about the Universal Genève, which is, that's, what is this? A chronograph, triple date, moon phase. What is missing? Nothing is missing there.
It really is sort of the poor man's 1518 or 2499. Yeah. Those Patek's that go for up to 10 million. You know, I find it so satisfying. Obviously, slight differences in production quality, but you know, they were for a while sold by the Henry Stern Company in New York. So really, there's quite a. I feel like they are worthy of being seen and spoken about in the same breath. I also own a Patek Calatrava, and it's interesting because I thought of getting, you know, what Mike has, the 570, which is a beautiful Calatrava. I've always been in love with that. That next to the Saxonia Thin would be a lot of fun. But I own one that's very maligned by many, or at least not, doesn't really interest a lot of collectors, which is the Calatrava 3445, which is a very strange late 50s, early 60s watch because it has these weird beveled lugs. It has a date, which again, not everyone loves, but I think is really beautiful and set aside in just beautiful white gold here. I don't know. I love this watch. I love the sunburst dial. The 570 is this excellent sort of masterclass in minimalism, which really, obviously someone wearing a Saxonia Thin is something I love, but the 3445, it may look like a grandpa watch from afar, but it has so many degrees of complexity to it.
Absolutely.
I absolutely love that watch.
So one with the sub seconds, right?
Yeah.
6 o'clock.
Seconds. 6 o'clock. Really love it. And again, that is a watch that only true watch nerds, especially those that specialize in vintage, really gets. Everyone else is like, where's your Aquanaut, you know?
Well, I mean, when you see Patek Philippe or Vacheron Constantin or whatever on the dial, then it's, you know, even if it's in the 50s, even if it's thin, even if it's small, even if it's a dress watch or a grandpa watch. I mean, I wish my grandpa was, you know, was.
I know.
Vacheron Constantin. Back there, probably my grandpa was rocking the same type of watches. Your grandpa?
What did my dad have? A Racchietta.
A Racchietta or a Polyot or one of those.
Polyot, Racchietta, definitely. Yeah, and those are actually, I think, made in my hometown in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Yeah, so Leningrad is in St. Petersburg, right?
Yeah, Leningrad. Right.
Crazy. So listen, we talked about all the watches, and we kind of mentioned them, you know, the books and stuff, but we haven't talked about, and it's kind of old story, but it isn't because it's from 2023, and I know you talked about it before, but we still need to mention this this TV show. That was this HBO TV show from earlier this year, and a lot of my colleagues, you know, were complaining that I should watch it, and that's Succession.
Oh, and yeah.
it's as I said, it's old news, but it isn't, because it's a very interesting show. For those of you who haven't seen it, please go and watch it. It didn't end the way I hoped it would end. But then every and I love HBO shows, from The Sopranos to The Wire and Rome and all those, you know, they never end the way I want them to end.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part, yeah, that's part of the fun.
Yeah, and you were involved, and I, as I said, I know you talked about this, but you were involved also with, I mean, with the, was the main topic, was it the watches, or that came after?
No, that came after. So I was involved, I can't claim to be, you know, one of the main writers or showrunners or producers, but I was involved in sort of in closer to the beginning when, because I'd written a book called Lake Success, the one that actually has all these watches, and it was about kind of a multimillionaire hedge fund guy. So I know the world I know the world that Succession represents quite well. A lot of it, obviously, is based in New York. These are media, but you know, in New York, money is its own category. You know, and all these worlds completely intersect, and so. Weirdly enough, you know, I mean, I'm not saying Succession is exactly modeled on the Murdoch family, but I was at a book club reading for my book, and there was one of the Murdochs was there, you know. So everything is very interconnected. So Jesse Armstrong, who was the brilliant showrunner of Succession, creator, showrunner, everything, he had read Lake Success, and he wanted me to come in. Actually, the show was, the writer's room was based out of London. And so I came to London for a while, which was a lot of fun because I don't know if they do this anywhere. HBO used to have a lot of money, and they put you up in a really fancy hotel. And I brought my whole family, and I remember there was the hotel had like a children's concierge, and I brought my kid who was like 5 years old, and concierge would like give him, you know, food for ducks in Hyde Park. It was it was kind of like being in Succession, right?
And London is a fun city.
London's a fun city. I do like London quite a bit. Yeah. And a fun watch city, obviously, too.
Yeah.
So I would wear my GMT, the one that we've been talking about quite a bit, to the writer's room, which was oddly enough in Brixton.
Not the fanciest part of the city, though.
Not the fanciest, but a really cool part. But I would take it on the tube to from the hotel to the writer's room. And I don't know how we started talking about watches, but I was saying, yeah. So, and people asked me, well, how much is that watch worth? And I think I told somebody, and they were like, what? Because non-watch people, especially back then, watches actually have become much more, fashionable or whatever you want to call it since then. But back then, nobody kind of knew what anything was worth. But, and then after the writer's room disbanded, and I didn't do too much more work with them, but I did, but Jesse would write to me sometimes and be like, okay, we have this watch thing. What should we put in? Right. And I think at the end, doesn't cousin Greg, I think he has a GMT, right? So if I'm not mistaken, I don't know if you got to that.
It's a
part.
Good, yeah. And I think,
that's what, because I think I suggested a GMT. I could be wrong, but because he buys like a vintage watch. I can't remember.
That's
but
a story.
That is kind of the GMT that I had in the room.
Yeah, that's
the anyway, storyline. So there is a little Succession crossover. But then I loved it, and I didn't write this line. And sorry if I'm spoiler alerting it, but one of the characters, I won't even say which one, but he's in a fight with his wife. I guess that reveals who it is. But he says to her, I like nice things. I like nice shirts. I like nice watches, you know. And even though I hadn't written that line, I certainly approved of it. At least the watches part, shirts, not so much.
Yeah, I think in the first, the very first episode when they're celebrating the birthday, and he also gifts a Patek.
Yeah, that's great.
That already sets the tone.
It sets the tone, and the guy's like, eh.
Thanks.
Yeah. When I was researching Lake Success, I met a lot of, you know, hedge funders who have billions of dollars under management, billions of dollars of assets under management. And they, most of them didn't even have a watch because I think the idea was the time kind of worked for them, not the other way around. There was like an assistant who would be basically a walking clock, you know.
Why would they?
Several assistants.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just a few weeks, no, actually last week, I was at the Porsche Museum, and in Stuttgart, right by.
I've been there.
Zuffenhausen, where the factory is, and it's a wonderful museum. It's a small museum, but it's
a beautiful museum. I'm not even a car head, but I love that museum.
Yeah, and have you been to the Mercedes-Benz Museum? It's even better. So it's huge. Work. It's like a. It's almost like a day, but half a day for sure. Mm-hmm. It's a huge, huge place. But anyways. And you see all kinds of people in this museum, right? You see the enthusiasts that probably never going to afford a Porsche. And you see the customers who just buy one every few years. And you see the watches, and it's so different. And you can see that there are people, you see the aspirational purchase guys, like, okay, I got a nice watch, and now I got a nice car. And you can tell, like, when you see a lady with, like, a very expensive Goyard bag and, like, a two-tone Daytona, chances, in my opinion, but that could be only me, chances are that she has really no, you know, kind of appreciation for the Daytona. It's like an expensive Rolex and it's two-tone, but that's that. But it's another expensive thing, expensive car, expensive bag, expensive, the whole nine.
Right. No, I definitely experienced that. There's definitely I am, how to put this? The financialization of watches has not been great. I mean, there was a time when my Aquanaut was worth probably $100,000, and obviously it's not, probably not even worth half of that. But it disturbs me because that's not why I got into watches. I believe, you know, I put money into my portfolio and it does just fine. You know, but it really distorted, as far as I'm concerned, this weird, weird hobby, this really strange hobby, because you know, cars are—they're designed to be flashy, and people recognize them, etc. But watches, unless it's some giant Rolex, are supposed to be only for the nerd that knows, the real enthusiast. And the fact that all of these things became, you know, an alternate asset class—that really rubbed me the wrong way. Oh my God,
I don't know what happened.
I don't know what happened there, but okay. A bunch of balloons just went across the screen. But. I almost missed the days when it would just be, you know, weirdos collecting strange stuff as opposed to people checking in and seeing how much their collection is worth three times a day or whatever.
Right. I mean, it's funny because sometimes I, you know, I drive my car and I realize that the watch on my wrist is worth more than the car, and I'm absolutely fine with that. I'm very, very happy with that. I really don't care. I mean, I would much rather just wear a nice watch. And I guess that's the difference between a watch fan and somebody else. I don't know.
Absolutely. I agree. And I think we were just praising Henry Flores, and his group is a bunch of guys who are really. You know, they have their special taste and they're all super cool, but, you know, I don't want to just see the same watch on everyone's wrist.
Well, but that's the beautiful thing about the watch community, right? You have people with different backgrounds, different, you know, shapes and sizes and colors and whatever, and tastes and wallets. And it's all fun to see a $10 Seiko or a Casio, a $100 Seiko and a $100,000 Patek Philippe. And once you find interest in it, that's cool. So last topic, and I know I'm going to put you on the spot, but Watch Fan's Guide to Reading.
Oh.
Gary Steingart's top three watch-related books, not necessarily yours.
I don't even know. I mean, I'm trying to think. Yeah, that's a really great – I mean, there's the famous – and now I'm forgetting. Oh, I think the poem was called Nevsky Prospekt by Pushkin. Mm-hmm. Was it called Nevsky Prospekt? Oh, Nevsky Prospekt is the main avenue of St. Petersburg where everything is. But there's a line which I love, where a dandy – stops in the middle of Nevsky to take out his breguet, I guess it's a pocket watch, and opens it up to look at it. And I don't know, that image is like, I don't understand why breguet doesn't use that. I guess many people don't know who Pushkin is, and maybe Russia isn't exactly the perfect country to be represented in 2023, but it's so cool because you sort of like get this idea that, you know, even centuries ago, at least this hipster was like, hey, look at my breguet, you know. I don't know. I find that a very funny mention.
And you're right. Then, like back in the late 19th century, I guess early 20, Russia was before the Bolshevik obviously took over. Mm-hmm. Was very heavy with watches, like Breguet,
Moser. Exactly. I was about to say Moser. Yeah.
Also, Fabergé was obviously not a watchmaker, but a jeweler. They all came from those times.
Yeah, I almost wonder, like, how is Yves Saint Ardenne going to survive now that it's hard for them to, I guess, sell their watches and, you know.
Yeah.
But that's very interesting. I'm trying to think of other books where watches play a huge role.
You can mention yours. Come on, give us one.
I remember the New York Times critic was like, oh, my God, what's with all these watches? You know, it's like, the book's okay, but why? But I think for watch nerds, I remember doing a reading and people would come up to me and I would sign their watch straps, you know, which I think is great. And, well, this isn't a book, but I would say Pulp Fiction has one of the most hilarious uses of a watch ever. And I love that because there's a kind of comical component with that. I won't even reveal because I know that maybe some younger people haven't seen Pulp Fiction yet. But if you like pocket watches and tight quarters, this would be a great movie for you.
There we go. Gary, we're just above 1 hour, 60 minutes. I don't want to, you know, keep you too long from enjoying the December dacha time and probably not swimming in the pool these days.
No, sadly, no.
But listen, it was so much fun. I was very happy to see you again and chat with you. And I hope to see you soon in New York or in Germany.
In Germany, yep.
Thanks a lot for taking the time. I owe you some books. I know we talked about this. I'll get you some books.
Excellent.
Really, thanks a lot for your time, and I hope to see you soon, man.
Yeah, peace. Take care.
Bye bye.